Do you like free booze and free stand-up comedy? Well, then you would love the Underground Comedy Show at the Bitcoin Center in Soho every Thursday at 7 p.m., unless it's raining, at 25 Cleveland Place.
And to donate, go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge.
You're listening to Burning Bridges with Margo on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com. On this episode, we have a very, very special guest. We have an amazing, hilarious comedian who is also my comedy coach and mentor, and he is going to be on a Judd Apatow show, Pete Holmes show, and he's filming a pilot about coaching comedians, which I make an appearance in since he's helping me, but he's not just a super, super funny guy. He's also a really nice guy, which I think is pretty rare. He's very talented in many different ways. And he tells us how he used to be a Mormon and some of the bridges he's burned in comedy and kind of where he's at now. Very interesting guy. Like, you can't make this stuff up. So definitely stay tuned for that. And then, because it's Mercury retrograde and technology's not working, you get to listen to some tunes afterwards. So check it out. Thanks for listening. Also, I have a big show coming up at Cornelia Street Cafe on September 17th. Cornelia Street Cafe is where the Vagina Monologue started. John Oliver had a show there. Susan Verga started there. It's a very historical, awesome place. And I'm hosting a comedy show. I'm producing it with fellow comedian Jonas Barnes. And it's all female comedians. And the headliner this month is Bonnie McFarlane. She's the best-selling author of You're Better Than Me and has been on Colbert, Last Comic Standing, Colin Quinn, HBO. And she's a co-host of a really popular podcast called My Wife Hates Me. So that is September 17th, Saturday, 6 p.m. You can get your tickets in advance at BonnieMcFarlaneLive.brownpapertickets.com. We recommend this because the venue is not that large, and it's $20, and that includes a drink. So definitely check that out. And then Radio Free Brooklyn is having a fundraiser party, and that is Saturday, September 10th. At 8 p.m. to 2 a.m., and it's at Union J in Bushwick. And so all proceeds of that go to building our new studio and a storefront. So definitely check that out. And I apologize about my voice. If you followed along the first couple episodes, I talk about how I had ulcers on my vocal cords, and I've gone through this whole vocal situation. I have a team basically helping me, vocalist, an ENT, GI doctor now, a vocal coach. So I'm not sure what's going on. Hopefully it's just me talking too much and eating the wrong stuff. But anyway, thanks for checking it out. Stay tuned for Dustin. And if you want to check him out, his website is www.dustinchafin.com. Thanks for listening. Do you like free booze and free stand-up comedy? Well, then you would love the Underground Comedy Show at the Bitcoin Center in Soho every Thursday at 7 p.m., unless it's raining, at 25 Cleveland Place.
And to donate, go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/pledge.
You're listening to Burning Bridges with Margo on Radio Free Brooklyn, and I'm your fire starter, Margo Avedisian. And I have a very special guest today. I have the amazing comedian, comedy coach, talent coordinator, Dustin Chafin, who's also going to be appearing on Judd Apatow's new show called Crashing. Thanks for being here.
Yay! Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're like the biggest name I've had so far. So I'm very excited about that.
says a lot about me or your show.
Yeah. I know. I probably shouldn't have told you that. I don't want to set the bar too high there. So the first question I always ask everyone is, what is a bridge you burned and then you realized it actually was the best thing to happen to you?
Wow, you don't mess around, man. You go in. You're like, hey, this guy, and okay, here you go. And so what did you do that ruined your career? So just share a little bit. Like, don't ease into it at all. There's no lube on this show. It's just straight fisting all the way through. Dry fisting, sure. Yeah, far as a comedian, I guess that's what we're going to ask.
But okay. Anything. Sometimes people talk about relationships, sometimes it's careers, sometimes it's...
Okay, I'll start with, I was a Mormon. I think that's definitely, I was a Mormon in high school, and I fell for this girl, and it was, this thing where I think I kind of broke up with her to kind of, like, well, I broke up with her, she broke up with me, I guess. And then I kind of became Mormon almost to get back at her. So I feel like that was one of those things. And I basically kind of became this super Mormon, you know, after high school. And when I say super Mormon, I mean I was all in. There was no caffeine. There was no coffee. There was no R-rated movies. There was no sex. There was no masturbation. There was, I mean, just as Mormon as a Utah kid could be.
And, you're
and I'm in Texas.
Clean shaven.
Yeah, as much. I mean, I actually had long hair and a ponytail in the 80s or whatever. You know, I was one of those biker looking guys. And always kind of been my look. But so I basically did that, was just kind of, you know, decided I was going to be a missionary. That's the super Mormon part. I decided I was just going to, like, you know, go all in with this stuff. And I'm going to be a missionary. And that seemed cool because the missionaries that taught me were, like, these cool dudes from Utah. They were nice. You know, that's how the Mormons kind of get you, because they're such nice people. And, like, my family's fucked up. And so, like, and then the Mormons were, like, just nice and, like, cook you dinner and ask you questions about your day and what are you studying, what are you doing. Like, it was just so friendly and open. And that's how they kind of reel you in, like a stray cats that have, like, shitty families. Is, you know, they're like, look, we're nice and, you know, we don't fight and throw shit in the house and do drugs on your birthday and not show up and, you know, that kind of shit. So that's how they kind of got me in. So anyway, the missionaries were involved in my life a lot, and I said that would be really cool to do that. And then I always heard that these missionaries go to crazy places. They go to, like, Japan and, like, Africa and, like, all these crazy places. So I just told myself, you know what? It's, like, the only way I'm going to get out of this shitty Texas town is maybe this is my key, because my grades suck. I'm not going to be able to get off of that. There's not a lot of opportunities. I wanted to be some sort of artist, but didn't know quite sure what it was yet. And so the Mormons had this thing where you, like, commit 2 years of your life and you're a Mormon missionary and you go where they want you to go. You don't get to pick. They send you somewhere. And then you basically just proselyte and teach people and just share this great thing that you have to other people across the world. And it just seemed kind of cool, you know, to go somewhere like Japan or somewhere interesting. So I signed up for it. And you basically have to just, you know, you write these papers, you fill out all these things. And I kind of knew a little loop on it. I figured out, like, I knew that if I mentioned I kind of knew another language, they'd probably send me, because that's how life is. Like, if you if you just kind of manipulate it a little, you might get something. Because I know if I didn't put a foreign language down, then they would probably send me to Utah or Idaho or somewhere completely awful and boring. So I knew that I had to kind of, like, you know, kind of manipulate it. Even I just knew it instinctually. I was like, I have to say something. So anyway, I took, like, one Spanish class and flunked. But told them, I was like, yeah, I know Spanish. And I was president of the Spanish club, lying as a missionary out of the gate. And so they ended up calling my mission, and meaning, like, they, you know, you get a letter. You open up the letter in front of all the other Mormon families, and everybody's all excited. By this point, my dad and I had kind of had a weird relationship, because he thought the Mormons were a cult. So he was, like, you know, sending preachers over to my house and, like, being all weird with me. And so, you know, we had a strained relationship because of this, because he's very straight up the middle Jesus Bible, you know, like, I think at the time he was Pentecostal or something. So it's really just that right-wing Fox News Jesus, you know, like, there's no other interpretation of religion. It's this way or no way. So anyway, we had a strained relationship. So so I was at this family's house that I was living with, Mormon family, and
they kind of, like, adopt you.
Pretty much. Yeah, I ended up liking another girl who was Mormon. Oh. The Mormon girls are great because they're just, like, they're pretty, they're natural, they're just, I don't know, there's something about Mormon girls I still have a thing for. I see them, like, yeah, I just, once in a while you'll see them, like, just, and I can just tell when a girl's Mormon. And they take care of themselves. I don't know, just the milky skin, I don't know what it is. I'm a sucker for good skin because you don't drink or smoke, you have nice skin. That's how it works usually. So anyway, so they pretty much adopted me, and I was living with this family. And so I opened up my letter, and it said I was going to the Canary Islands in Spain.
Oh, wow.
That's where they told me I was going. I got so freaking excited.
Yeah.
I was like, this is amazing, because I'm an art guy, too. So it was like Salvador Dali has his own, like, bull arena there and everything, and, like, everything's... I looked it up. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's off the coast of Morocco. Like, all this stuff. I was like, this is amazing. And so, I couldn't have been called to a cooler place. And so I'm like, this is great. So I basically got prepared for that. You know, you're like, you know, crash course in Spanish, trying to, like, do all these stuff and reading about it. I'm so excited. You know, this is amazing. It's so cool. This is not Utah. This is, like, a cool freaking place. So I get all excited. And then they send me to the Missionary Training Center. And that's where they basically... They teach you how to be missionary, and they teach you how to do it in the language that you're called in, so Spanish. So, yeah. So you're basically, they just, you know, every day you wake up, you're with probably about 2,000 other guys that are waiting to go on their missions, and you're in, it's in Provo, Utah, and you're in the Missionary Training Center, you know, and as soon as you walk in, you're ready to go. You got your short hair, you got your tie, you got your name tag.
Your
white shirts,
you
got your backpack, your white shirts, your Book of Mormon, your Bible. You're just ready to go. Like, you set up and you're, now I'm a missionary. This is the first step. This is boot camp. This is like missionary boot camp. So you show up and they just, you know, and like, I'm a convert. Like, nobody in my family is like Mormon. It was like, you know, I'm kind of the odd man out. There's a few of us, but not that many. Most people are from Utah or Idaho or Vegas or somewhere where there's a lot of Mormons. And, So I go in, and it's cool, though. You know, I just meet a lot of the guys. Or, you know, we have, like,
it's
a little...
It's only guys?
No, there's girls, too. There's some girls, sisters, they call them. And it's weird. They're older than the men, because I think it's such a chauvinistic thing, but I think what they want to do is they want to keep the women here in case they can get married. And then if they're not married by 21, then, like, okay, I guess you can be a missionary. Because the men are, like, 19. So most of the men are 19 and the women are 21. So that's the age difference.
Oh.
So, but it is. They're trying to get them married off. That's,
yeah, like,
whole,
21, you're a spinster at that point.
Yeah. You old hag.
Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah.
You got nothing left in you. So might as well just go preach or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the mentality. And so I basically did that.
And you went to the Canary Islands?
Well, here's it. Okay. There's a curveball in here. A little U-turn thing that happens. And so... So I'm in the Missionary Training Center, and I think I did something wrong with my visa or something, like filled it. I didn't know how to do any of this shit. And they kind of helped me. Some people helped me, but I don't know if they helped me right. Whatever. So it ended up being a problem where they were having some visa issues with me and about, you know, something with the thing. It didn't go through or something. And so they decided to send me back home. But they didn't realize it was my home. They call it stateside. So basically, a lot of missionaries that are going on foreign missions, they'll send them somewhere like California or Utah or Idaho or wherever to kind of wait on their visas. And so they'll basically be a missionary, you know, in Ohio or something. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, they get their visa, they get on a plane, they go to the mission they're supposed to go to. So they end up sending me to literally my hometown. And this has never happened. Ever. And I mean, every person I've ever talked, this has never happened. They've never sent somebody back where their parents are and their friends. And nobody, because they want to avoid that. Because they want, you're not supposed to, like, have interaction with your parents for 2 years. You can call them on the phone, like on Mother's Day and shit, but it's, like, letters only.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like they want to keep you focused, brainwashed, whatever, however you want to use it. But it's so basically, yeah, they send me home. And so, you know, I was a rock and roll guy with a motorcycle, long hair. I go back, I got a bicycle and a name tag and a tie. You know, it's like, it's the opposite world. People are like driving up, old friends, what the, you know, chafing. So it was just horrible. And Yeah, so I was waiting on my visa, all these things, and I was a missionary in Texas for, it felt like forever. It was, I think it was like 3 months. It was the longest 3 months.
Was that scary? Like, you're just going to strangers' houses in Texas.
Yeah, it was really scary, and,
did anyone, like, pull a gun on you?
Nobody pulled a gun on me, but I guarantee you I went into a few apartments of people that probably killed somebody. There's a couple of guys where I'm like, you gotta be hiding a body somewhere. And a lot of these guys, that's the thing too, is a lot of people, like, because that's what you do. You proselyte, you know, they teach you how, at the Missionary Training Center, they teach you how to, they call these things discussions. In Spanish, they're called charlas. But you basically... there's a step-by-step process into converting somebody. You know, there's, I mean, it's like, it's a whole program. It's like a, you know, like one of those how-to, you know, things where it's like, first, you know, you learn relationships and trust, you know, how to, like, you know, talk to people. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? How to kind of be familiar with them. Like, if you're playing basketball, like, hey, I used to play basketball, or hey, my favorite player's Jordan, or, you know, you figure out little manipulative ways to kind of, like, kind of get in the door, or talk to him on the street or whatever it is. And so you learn all this stuff. And so, but in Texas, the difference between Texas and then where I ended up going, which was a foreign mission, foreign people are so excited that there's an American, A, speaking Spanish, and B, he's American. And we don't know, we've only seen them on TV, so this is so exciting. So they'll let us in. They don't care. They have them, they have no intention of converting, but they're so excited to talk to an American. And so you have that going for you. And then in the States, in Texas, my experience was there's so many lonely people that just need somebody to talk to. They can't afford a therapist, or they just don't interact with other people. So these creepy people would, I mean, we'd be like in these shitty towns in Texas with like shitty apartments and stuff. And yeah, just any guy home during the day is probably out of work and creepy. And so it's like, you know, it's, yeah, a lot of times, you know, someone would open up the door and let us in, and it'd be all smelly and weird. But, you know, we're missionaries, so we're like, oh, you know, the God's with us, so we're cool. It's that blind faith. You're not scared because, like, God's got my back, you know. So, and then there's the second one. There's the creepy guys. One guy was like, made us cheese sandwiches. It was just like really uncomfortable. And like, he tried to get money out of us. Like, can you loan me money? One of those guys. One guy was feeding his cat green beans. It's like, that's how broke he was. His cat was eating green beans. It was like running around, like, just give me food and like eating green beans. I've never seen a fucking cat eat green beans, but I did see it this time. And so, and then the other thing was either the lonely, weird guys, which you kind of feel sorry for, or the guys that would bait you. Like, yeah, come on in. Yeah, oh, you're missionary. Oh, that's great. I've always wondered about the Mormons. And then once they get you on their couch, then they're like pulling out highlighted scriptures. You're going to hell. The Mormons are wrong. And they just want to convert you.
Oh, my God.
So they're like, we got to get you out of this. This is a cult. It's wrong. And you're, Jesus Christ is one way only. It's not through this bullshit. And they're just basically trying to, like, convert you and just turn it. Yes, they're turning it on you. So it's, like, mortified. You're just like, what the? And you're just yelling and going back and forth.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I'm like,
oh. You're like a kid, too.
Yeah, so 19, almost 20. I was a little older. I was almost 20. Most of the guys are right 19 and they go, I was like, almost 20. I turned 20 right. Like,
did you convert anyone?
I did. I was an amazing missionary. Because I was a really good missionary. I mean, I'm pretty good at most things I attempt, but missionary was like the first thing I really focused in on. And it was like, I had a good angle. Because I was like, I'm a convert. I know what you're feeling. I didn't just grow up in this. So I understand your concerns and your doubts. So I could pull that kind of like, you know, that just vulnerability, you know, which I eventually learned it, that it works at other things, like dating or whatever. But it's a little vulnerability that girls will go for. that's all love is. So I'll cut to the stuff real pretty quick. So anyway, I'll tell you this story. It's on my album, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And so I ended up, you know, I had a situation where, you know, I got sick. I had a prostate problem and, you know, I was having some problems. And I had to go to the doctor while I was in Texas. And basically the doctor said, you know, it's like you have a backup. you know, and you, you know, there's a, like a sperm backup, and you have to, you're gonna have to jerk off in order to kind of like relieve all this, this problem that's happening. And, you know, as a missionary, we have a vow of chastity. We're not supposed to touch ourselves or touch another woman or anything. Like, we're basically priests. And so, you know, it became this thing where it went through all the higher channels of the church. And, like, my missionary president was, like, mortified by the letter. He's like, well, I guess you're just going to have to die. You're not going to be jerking off as a missionary. You're a missionary. You know, it's like you have this, like, you know, it's like the guy, the Watchtower guys in the freaking Game of Thrones. You know, you have this, like, they're guarding the walls. And same with missionaries. So they take it really serious. So this thing went all the way to Salt Lake City. It went all the way to, like, the Mormon Pope, if you will, like, the highest guy in the Mormon Church. So all these people were, like, you know, basically praying and trying to figure out whether I could jerk off and get away with it and not go to hell. And, like, would it be okay? What's worse? This kid dies because it's a prostate problem. Or he jerks off and, like, he gets better, but he's jerking off. He's going to jerk off too much. He's going to jerk off every day. Can he be a missionary and jerk off? There was just, like, this horrible... It was back and forth.
So embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. Because it's... Yeah. Because I'm trying to be a good dude. Because I was a piece of shit before. I was girls, rock and roll, blah, blah, blah. So this was my way of kind of, like, trying to get rid of that guy and move on and, like, I'm just going to change my life. I'm going to, you know, no girls, no bullshit, whatever. I'm going to just change my life. And so, and then I just get right back into, you know, so it was like really weird, embarrassing, and crazy. And then they ended up, you know, seeing that I could jerk off. And then that was uncomfortable because missionaries, you know, they talk like comics. Like, they're like, hey, this guy can jerk off. So, like, people would, you know, greet me with, like, a hand job sign. And, you know, it got a little weird. But I was like, sorry, dude, doctor's orders. I'm going to go to the bathroom. You guys have your little prayer group. But so there was all that craziness. Okay. So all that happens. Jerking off missionary. I ended up, you know, getting well. But I think I went a little longer than I was supposed to.
Like your doctor's note.
It's like, yeah, I was like, dude, why is this right now? I'm just saying, it came back, sorry. But so I got rid of that and everything was fine. So I'm a legit missionary, I'm not jerking off anymore. And so they say, hey, your visa came in. I'm like, this is amazing. I finally get to leave Texas. I finally get to get out of this goofy ass town that I tried. The only reason I did this was to get out of Texas, and then they sent me right back. So geez. And so I finally get to leave Texas. I get to, I've never been outside the, been to Bermuda. I was living when I was a kid or whatever. That was it. I never went anywhere foreign other than that. So I was really excited to just, you know, go to Spain. And Spain. Picasso. Spain. Amazing. And so I get to the airport. I get to the missionary training center. Or, like, not missionary training center. The mission office. They have, like, an office in Texas for the Texas missionaries. So everything's there. So I'm like, I'm going to Spain. So I get there, I grab my envelope, and it's got my plane tickets in it, and it's got my visa in it, and they're driving me to the airport. I'm like, yes, this is it. So in the back of the car, I'm looking at the envelope, and I'm like, you know, just open it up, and I'm like, open it up, and it says Santiago, Chile. I said, what do you mean Santiago, Chile? And I'm looking at it again. I'm like, no, I'm supposed to go to the Canary Islands, paradise. That's not some third world country. I'm supposed to go to Canary Islands. And so I'm just devastated. Like, I don't even know. I'm making phone calls. Who do you call? Like, I don't even know. I'm calling the Texas guy. He doesn't know what to do. I'm trying to call. I'm upset. I'm teary-eyed. I'm like, I want to go to the Canary Islands. I don't want to go to freaking Chile. God. Crappy-ass Chile. So I ended up, you know, just going through with it. I was like, well, I talked to somebody. They were like, you're going to Chile. So I just said, all right, I guess God wants me to go to Chile. God, I was a sucker. I should have fought that one harder. And so I end up on a plane. I go to South America. And I'm just like flying the thing. I end up in Santiago, Chile. And I'm official. You know, I'm like I'm in South America. I'm a missionary, you know. And so it's at least way more exciting than being a freaking missionary in Texas. So I was happy about that. And I'm there, and it's crazy, and it's just, you know, it's probably about maybe 400 missionaries, and we're all in Santiago, Chile, and each of those, like, north and a south and, like, different parts of the area where there's missions, and mine was Santiago North, and we were mostly the city, and it was great, you know, at first, you know, it was cool, and I enjoyed it, and, you know, Chile's hot, but it's, you know, it's still cool, it's interesting, you know, it's just like, it's something I've never experienced before, you know, colors and people, and, like, this smell, the color's not the color of the people, but, like, the vibrance of, like, cloth and things, you know what I'm talking about. Whenever you see, like, you know, like a Jason Bourne movie where he's being chased, it's always interesting where he's always running in through, you know, clothes and things. But it was cool. I enjoyed it. It was great. And then, and I was a good missionary. It was, I ended up being a super missionary. I baptized the most people out of anybody in my mission. I was unbelievable. I was a missionary machine. I baptized 1 month. I baptized, like, 19 people. That's unheard of. Like, in 1 month. 19, because we
do you put them in water, like, you actually
you baptize them in the ocean, or you baptize them in, like, a thing that's designed at the church for baptizing. It was basically a tub, like a big tub where you just dump people in. But,
so, like, if you sign someone up, if you get to baptize them, that's
well, that's the whole, that's the exciting part. Like, you
crazy.
Basically you know, you run them through the chart of the discussions, you know, you run them, you know, it's pretty it's laid out pretty well. It's, you know, it's pretty simple and clear. People, they know what they're getting into, pretty much. I don't think they realize the intensity of the Mormon church or what happens at, like, the higher levels of the temple and things like that. But basically, it's just, you know, you're accepting this doctrine, and you're accepting Jesus and the Holy Ghost and God the Father into your life. And the symbolism through washing your sins away is done through baptism. So I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and then I just immerse you, and then I pull you up, and you're baptized. And your life is just awesome now.
And then they can't drink or...
No, well, they can do whatever they want, but they make a vow to be a Mormon. So you're basically, you choose to not smoke, you choose to not drink. I mean, you know, I mean, there's definitely a lot of people that weigh off of that, but, you know, it's definitely, you know, the decision you make, you know, when you become a Mormon. It's like, this is it, I'm going to do this. And, you know, I did it for about, I was a perfect missionary. After I stopped beating off, I was a good missionary. And I didn't last too long. I probably went about 4 years solid Mormon.
Wow. How long were you in Chile for?
A little under 2 years.
Oh.
Probably about a year and, you know, because I spent that time in Texas. So it was like, you know, a year and 8 months or something. And but it was crazy. I was a branch president, they call it, which is, I don't know if you know what that means.
No.
But it's basically like the preacher of a church. Like, because there was this island that's called Robinson Crusoe Island. And it's the reason they call it Robinson Crusoe Island, it's about 250 miles off the coast of Chile. And apparently in like 1850-something, for maybe 1840s, there was this captain of the Navy, Alec Sirclerc, and he basically, they shipwrecked near this island, and he washed up ashore, and he ended up being the only survivor of this shipwreck. And it's a true story. And he lived on this island by himself for like 3 years or something, and basically just figured out, you know, all he had was like a Bible that was in his pocket, and he figured out how to fish, how to live off the land and the whole island. And he basically was a celebrity, and they rescued him like 3 years later, and he was a celebrity in England. And then Daniel Defoe was one of the authors at the time, who was like a big author, and then inspired Daniel Defoe to write the book Robinson Crusoe Island, which is a famous book, and it came from his story. So it was inspired by him. So anyway, I lived on this island. So it's in the middle of freaking nowhere. And it's like, it's just 200 people. And I lived with a fisherman and his family. We had dirt floors, you know. It's like, it was just crazy. Little huts, like, it's crazy. Banana trees, getting banana. We made our own jam. We made our own bread. We, you know, we lived with a fisherman. So I ate a lot of lobster, which was cool. And, but just fresh fish out of the ocean. And it was like every morning just hear like sea lions barking. That's what woke us up. Like just hundreds of them on the rocks. And it was cool, man. It was definitely, so I basically was the preacher, you know, so in Spanish, mind you. And so I'm just, you know, preaching every Sunday and setting up the church. And I ran this little tiny little, about the size of this comedy club. And I'm just like, you know, teaching Sunday school and I'm counseling married couples. I'm barely 20 and I'm telling, you know, hey, you should be nicer to her and listen, shut up, stupid. So yeah, I'm doing stuff like that. Teaching kids English and things, which I enjoyed it. And on the island, it was kind of like a Peace Corps situation where it was like one of those things where you're just always helping people. And like, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of times people would come to the church because we had food, you know, we fed a lot of people, you know, so it was stuff like that. And then I started doing stuff that, you know, I put on the first dance they ever had on the island. The kids had never had a dance. And so I had, you know, we're not supposed to have, you know, any sort of outside music. It's supposed to be just instrumental or whatever. But I smuggled like B-52s in and shit like that. So I had all this like music. Had some that was sent to me, and I had it was like cassette tapes, and I'm like trying to like, you know, but I was DJing, I know you like DJs, and I was DJing this little Mormon dance, and it was the most amazing thing ever to see these kids, like, you know, there was only like, probably about 26 of them, but they'd never had a dance, and it was they'd seen it, TV and movies, and, you know, they knew what it was, but they never had like a dance for them, you know, nobody had ever done that for them. And it was just really cool, just stuff like that. And but yeah, I really enjoyed being on the island and all this stuff. And so the mission itself was great. And I was like, I ended up working in the office. Actually, before the island, I was the mission historian. I ran the... I've done everything. I really have. Every time I talk, I think I'm lying, but I'm not. I'm really not. Every time I tell anybody any parts of my life, I'm like, I swear to God. So... but yeah, I ran the mission magazine. Like we would basically keep tabs on how many people were baptizing, because that's how they motivated you too. They kind of made it like sports-like, and you know, we're like, okay, so this guy had 10 this month. This guy had 6. This guy had 10.
You had 18. Like prizes. Like, you got 10 today.
I don't think there were prizes, but it was definitely bragging rights, yeah. You know. But it might have been some sort of. You know what? It might have been, you get to eat. The food was really bad in Chile. So, and our mission presidents, basically it's always, usually a married couple. It's always a guy. And most of the time, the mission president and his wife is usually some boar from Utah. We really lucked out. We got this Hawaiian couple, and they were amazing. And he was like this big, fat Hawaiian, and he sang with like this harp, and he was fantastic. Anyway, she was an amazing cook. So she would cook all this Hawaiian, like a roasted pig. It was really good because the food sucked outside of this house. And the only two times food was good was McDonald's and eating at their place. So if you've baptized a lot, they would let you eat there. So it was like, that was the motivation, just to have like real mashed potatoes or whatever. And so, yeah, so I was a good missionary, and I still hold the record, I think, 19 people in 1 month. I've asked around, and apparently I'm the winner. I'm the champ. I'm the Jordan of missionaries. So, I'm the LeBron James of missionary work. But, so yeah, it was fun, man. I had a really good time. And it was one of those things where, you know, it's like, you know, you don't really know what's happening until you step away from it. But, you know, far as the doctrine and what's true and what's not true and, you know, is this some sort of cult? Is this manipulating my life? Are they trying to like change my ways and make me some weird servant to this thing? You know, you don't notice all that at when you're just in it like a missionary, because it's a bunch of young dudes. You know, I never had any friends like this. It was like guys that were like I'd never been able to be friendly with a jock guy, you know, because, you know, just like it was a different circle I was in. When I was in high school, we were like the new wave punk rock kids, and then it was like the jocks with the enemy and whatever. So it allowed me to kind of like interact with these guys, and like really it showed me how to like talk to people and how to like embrace relationships. It was really cool, man, and it got me to, like I said, get out of Texas, you know, and see the world and really get a vision on how things are in different places of the world. And if anything, it taught me how to talk, speak in public. Like, I never did anything like that. I was terrified. the shyest kid ever. So this, you know, it forced me. I had to, like, hey, talk to people in another language. So the vulnerability and just, like, trusting, you know, yourself and just doing stuff. So it was really cool. I enjoyed the missionary work. It was really great. And I had a fabulous time. And coming back was not so easy, but the missionary part was great because I felt like it was, I was just, was such a group of people. And so everybody, whenever you're with somebody, you all have the same vision and the same thing. It's like, it's just so much easier, you know? And I feel like I find that in comedy now. Like, that stand-up comedy is like that for me now. I think that's why I was drawn to this, because it's such a sisterhood and brotherhood. There's so many, like, there's so many of us, like you and I, like, we, you know, we just met, but we feel like we kind of have a lot in common because we have a similar vision for a dream and all this. So we automatically kind of, like, connect. And so I really enjoy that part about it. But anyway, so when I got back from Chile, it was a little different. My mom, she had married a plastic surgeon, remarried. This was her fourth marriage. And she worked at his office, and then he ended up divorcing his wife and marrying my mom. And so that was kind of interesting. And so I had to move back in with my mom, because, you know, you're just out of a mission, you know, you're just, you got nowhere to go. I sold everything. I sold my motorcycle. I sold everything to go on this mission.
Would they make you pay for it?
Here's what they do. They make you any sort of contribution that you can do, you do. Which I sold all my shit. I sold my Jeep. I sold my motorcycle. And then they basically take care of everything else. They want you to get rid of your as much as you can, and then they'll take care of everything else. So basically, you know, I got rid of some cool shit, but then they ended up taking care of everything else. The 2 years is a long time to pay for stuff, so it's like, even the stuff I sold wasn't much. And so they end up kind of like sweeping in and taking care of whatever you need to pay for. Sometimes they'll pay for the whole thing, but that's part of the plan. If you have something, you can sell or whatever. But so I moved back home, and that was weird. Because, you know, my mom didn't know how to deal with me. You know, she's like, you know, just kind of one of those moms that is just like running around, drinking, going crazy, tight clothes, you know, that kind of mom. So it was like, it was definitely, you know, and then I get to the airport, she's not there. She like, so I'm alone at the airport. You know, the whole thing was a tragedy once I got back. And I ended up living with my mom and my stepdad, and I tried to be Mormon in Texas, and that was very difficult. And there was a few Mormon churches and stuff, and you know, they kind of accepted me a little bit, but it was still weird and whatever. And then they had this like junior college, basically a mini BYU, and it's in Rexburg, Idaho. It was called Ricks College. And it was a Mormon school, but it was a 2-year kind of junior college. And so that's where, you know, I could have shitty grades and I could still be around a bunch of Mormons. And so I needed that again, you know? So my mom took care of me, and we ended up kind of enrolling me into this thing. And I ended up going to this little community college in Rexburg, Idaho, in the middle of nowhere. And that was great, you know. It was like the first time I was around, again, since my mission, around all these missionaries that just, they just come back. And so everybody's kind of like, you know, we're trying to figure our lives out. And, you know, and it's just like lots of girls and these cute little Mormon girls and all this energy's happening. And it's the same kind of thing. It's just like, as long as there's a bunch of people doing the same thing, you're fine. I think that's when you're just clueless to everything, and it's like you can enjoy your life as long as there's a bunch of people doing it. And so I went to the school and met a couple of girls. I was engaged a couple of times. I thought I was going to marry a couple of girls, and that didn't really work out. And because that's kind of why you go there too. You think you're going to get a wife, and they really pushed that on you. I think there was 3 girls I was engaged to, and
oh, wow.
It's like one of these weird things where it's like you can't have sex,
yeah.
So you're just horny as shit. And then they tell you to marry somebody, and so you think it doesn't really matter. Like, you don't think about, like, now it's like, I've been with my girl 10 years, we're still not married, and we wear rings and everything. So it's like, that's how much I weight now. But that back then it was like, oh, let's just get married, I want to have sex. So I ended up kind of like falling off a little when I was in the church. Like when I ended up kind of not being a good boy. And my Mormonism started to slip the longer I was at the college. And that's when kind of the decline started. And I ended up, you know, sleeping with this girl, and it was like a huge deal. And we were like just, you know, weren't supposed to do it, and we were hiding it. We were like under the stairwells and back of cars. Like, you know, there's no, you know, you can't let everybody know you're banging at, you know, at a Mormon school. So we were hiding around under stairwells. It was crazy. And bathrooms or whatever. And it was, and that's when it started kind of like, I started realizing that obviously I'm getting out of this. This is obviously my views on what I think this is. And I think my doctrine started kind of fading a little, like the, like what I believed in started fading. And I just had other dreams and other plans. And I started to get a little college under me and realized I wasn't as stupid as I thought I was. And I just was able to start to believe in myself. And then I said, you know, I always wanted to be a fashion designer. And I always wanted to go to New York City. That's something I always wanted to do. And so I'm gonna switch my major, and switch my major, clothing and textiles, and I started doing that. I started, you know, like learning how to like design stuff and drape clothing and make patterns and all that shit. And I thought that's what I was gonna do, and I ended up, applying to Parsons in New York. And I was just like, you know what, I'm gonna do this. It's gonna be great. And so I got in. I don't know why they let me in, and they let me in. And then I was just like, so it was like this transition. And so I had this girl. She kind of thought I was going to marry her. And then I was just like, I got into this freaking school of schools when it comes to like art and fashion. So I was like, all right. So I ended up coming here, New York. And that's when, you know, the Mormon thing was kind of on the back burner. I was still Mormon. And I remember I got here, as soon as I got here, I mean, I'd had sex, but I hadn't told anybody. But I got here, and then one of my missionary buddies, who was in the office with me when I was the historian, he was the accountant, and he was at Columbia. And so I came here, and like we ended up being really friendly, and I was really so happy he was here, because New York was such a, just a, oh my God, it was worse than South America. Like, I, you know, when you get here, it's like you have to figure it all out, and it's crazy.
When was this, what year?
This was 92, maybe. And so it was crazy, and I was just trying to figure everything out. And yeah, it's like just crazy. Maybe 93. Yeah, 91, I was on the mission. Maybe 93, 94, somewhere right there. And so, so I'm here, and then I would go to the church. I would go to the Mormon church. And that was a weird Mormon church, because it was like, you could tell some of the guys were gay. You know, you just like there was it was great. Now looking back, I'm like, that's amazing. But then it was just like whatever, dude. And it was because it was a lot of the Mormons are very talented people, like when it comes to like singing and dancing and stuff like that. So a lot of them were at Juilliard, and so you know you have these amazing, you know, talents that were just in this church. They were all Mormon, single Mormons, and like we're all together. And so it was kind of like a some of them were kind of judgy, but then there were a few of us that were kind of like the dark Mormons, you know, that I think we all kind of connected, because we knew like, yeah, there's no way you're fucking putting up and keeping this bullshit and like believing it, but we're gonna but it's nice to be around people, you know, they're nice to us, so we have a base. Because when you're in New York, you're so lost, you know, you don't know what's going on. So now, you know, we, you know, I wasn't a bar person yet, so it was like this was my social life, you know. I was the DJ at the dance, you know? So and the first time I did stand up though was at the Ricks College in Idaho. I did the Mormon talent show. First time I did stand-up.
You did Mormon jokes?
I
like,
did.
What do you do jokes
I did.
About?
I did. It was hilarious. I got a standing ovation. Like, I killed it. I don't think I've matched that set. I've been chasing my first set
for
15 years. I was on stage, and I was just making fun. I'd always liked comedy. It's a big Kinison guy, and Carlin and all that. Bad stuff that I loved, and like just like edgy material, and I was good. I just talked about like the lunchroom, because they were getting, we were getting in trouble because people were like throwing food away and not drinking all their juices. So just stupid jokes. Like, it's like, you know, yeah, I was just trying to get out. I got handcuffed and like hit in the head because I didn't finish my grape juice. And you know, making fun of the stuff. Like, hey, who wants to get married? Raise your hand. You know, just stupid stuff like making fun of the vibe. Yeah. And it really, I mean, it's like, whoo, like it just came over me. I was like, I mean, I was good for somebody who'd never done it. And people went crazy. And I was like, oh, this, I love this, how this feels. And I did so well. They stood up, they clapped, it was Chris cheering me on, it was fantastic. I did a long time, I did like 7-8 minutes, like, which is really long when you first do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and then I remember afterwards, I did so well that they decided to do just a comedy show, not a talent show, but just a comedy show. So they were auditioning all these people, and then I remember I had new material. And because even then I knew, hey, I can't do the same shit. You know, I've never even done this. And so I remember I wrote all this other stuff that was a little, like, little edgier. It was making fun of, like, the only reason people are here because, you know, to get married and da, 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 da. And, like, you know, people are just jonesing for caffeine or whatever it was I said. It was edgier stuff that was more making fun of the Mormons a little. And, and the only reason they were doing the comedy show was because of me. So they auditioned all these idiots to be on the comedy show with me. I was the dude, the headliner. And then I got called. They cut me off the show because my material was too edgy. And they told me I was too edgy. Like, I had to kind of let them know what kind of material I was going to do. So I was like, I got some new stuff. And then they were like, nah, man, you're done. And so that was my first realization on how unfair comedy can be. Is that, this, you know, even if you kill, there's always some asshole that's going to bring you down because you're not saying what they want you to say. So, yeah, that was a rude awakening. And then they were all hacks. These three guys that did it, they were terrible. And everybody hated the show. And they were all like, Dustin should have been on it. Like, it became this, like, this controversy. It was like everybody was talking about, hey, man, Dustin, funny at all, you both, you know. Like, it just became this thing. Like, everybody was, I was just, my reputation started then. And, It was hilarious. And so, you know, but then I came here. And then my second time to do stand-up was here in New York at the other Mormon talent show. And
you started, or?
No. Okay. It was at the church here. You know, they have a church like on 66th Street over what they do. It's over by Juilliard. It's across the street, or across the street from Lincoln Plaza, which I think Juilliard's over there. And so they had a church talent show. And so that was the second time I did stand-up, was on that. And I was all, I remember I fell off the stage because I've been doing this hacky thing. I was doing this, like, thing where it's like, I was doing impressions of Mick Jagger, and I, like, played the song, like, Can't Get No Satisfaction, but I had a magnifying glass in front of my face, so my lips looked really big. So I thought I was a genius. And then, like, the lips were big. It's ridiculous. And I fell off the stage because I was so into it, and it was, like, ridiculous.
By accident?
Oh, yeah. I acted like it was on purpose.
That sounds hilarious.
Yeah, it was actually pretty funny. And so I got my taste of that. And then, so, you know, this Mormon relationship between just trying to kind of, like, you know, stay in it, and but at the same time, I was kind of, like, edging my way out of it, you know? And I was, like, just so happy to be in New York and all these things. And I ended up trying to, you know, the hardest thing was I ended up trying to be a Mormon in a way that it suited me, and then become this New York City artist, and then become this, like, free spirit that I'd never really had a chance to be. And so I would date, like, a Mormon girl or something, and then we'd go too far, and then she would make it this big thing, and then she ended up, this one girl, Karina, she was an actress and stuff, and she ended up ratting me out and telling, like, the church leaders that, you know, I didn't have sex, I just fooled around, like, she made this big thing. And so I had church court, had to go to church court.
What?
I had to talk to, like, these people and announce my sins and, like, say all these things that I had done. And so it was like, and it was weird because they really liked me. Like, all the people here in New York, and the guy still likes me, you know, state president or something, and he liked me, you know, and I liked him, and we still Facebook friends and stuff, but it was like, he didn't want to have to do it, but he had to basically excommunicate me because I was having sexual relations with girls I wasn't paying my tithe, which you got to supposed to pay 10% of your money, and I wasn't going to church all the time, and you know, I might have dabbled in pot and things like that. So it was like I was obviously weaning off. So that would be, you know, when my bridge was burned with the Mormon Church. It's basically just, you know, I just wanted to be this New York City guy, you know. I'd always grown up like just Lou Reed and New York Times, and I just wanted to be, I didn't want religion tying me down. I didn't want religion like being over me. So it was like, I made that choice, you know? I mean, I didn't like choose, I didn't say, hey, I want out of this. I just kind of like, I burned it through, you know, just heavy petting with girls and, you know, the choir director and, you know, you know, stuff like that, you know, just grabbing boobs and stuff. And yeah, and then I ended up, you know, when I was, you know, I mean, art school girls, forget it. I mean, they're all another level, you know. Girls from Amsterdam and all that stuff. So I think I kind of, you know, just being a regular boy, young 20-year-old something, it's like just basically just kind of living the life I'm supposed to be living at 20-something, college, New York City. So I, yeah, so I ended up just choosing that life, you know, of not becoming a Mormon, of not being a Mormon anymore. And I basically just gave it up. And I said, you know, and then I found stand-up, you know, really found it this time. And I was, it was funny, my Mormon, the last part of it goes with the Mormon girl. So this, the Mormon girl that ratted me out, she worked at a hotel with another guy who was a comedian. His name was Pete Corielli. He's kind of done a lot of stuff, did a Showtime special and stuff. But he ended up, he worked at the New York Comedy Club, and he was a busboy. And he used to, you know, bus and cook and all that stuff. And that's how I ended up getting my job there as a busboy and a cook, was through him. Like, he ended up, you know, becoming, like, friends with Jim Brewer and all these other comedians. He ended up kind of, you know, doing road work, and so I got his job. And so that's how I transitioned into comedy, was just like, he's like, you know, hey, I need somebody to cook burgers and, you know, clean the toilets for 5 minutes of stage time, and you get like $3 and if you cook. And so I ended up doing that for about a year and a half, and that's how I met Al Martin, who, you know, we've run a lot of stuff together, and I run the Greenwich Village Comedy Club with him and all these things. And so that's when my comedy life opened up, was, you know, over there, and I started getting up and, you know, just becoming a comic and getting up on real shows, because I always hated open mics, because I remember when I just tried to do that and I hated it. So this is, I was able to work at this club and do this stuff. So anyway, my life has changed. I ended up getting a degree at Parsons, but it was just like, it wasn't fashion. I ended up working in fashion. I worked at Calvin Klein for about a year and a half. I did that. I thought I was going to, that's what I thought I was going to do. But then comedy kind of like became this thing I was more attracted to. But I tried to do the, I had an internship at Calvin Klein, then I got a job there, and then I thought I was going to do that, and then stand-up kind of at the tail end of that, and ended up saying stand-up's way cooler than working in a factory all day, where three people make millions and everybody else makes less than 30 grand a year. Yeah. So yeah, I'm cool. I think I'll just tell dick jokes in a basement for the rest of my life. And so yeah, so I ended up doing that, and comedy became my new religion. Comedy became something that was more powerful than Mormonism ever was, you know, because it allowed me to be me. It was nobody telling me anything. I chose it. I wrote the doctrine. You know, I got to do and say and be and dress and whatever, any way I wanted to be. And that's, man, that was what really attracted me to stand up, was that I was oppressed for a little while in my life, and then it was like able to kind of like break out of that. Stand-up is a great thing to jump into once you've been in a cult or a religion or something. It's a great thing. We're like, hey, I can just say whatever I want and be whatever I want and dress and do. And nobody tells me anything. I can freaking do shots of coke right now if I want. I can run it off. I can wear leather pants and cowboy hats and do whatever. Nobody was stopping me. And so I ended up going a little too crazy for a while, because I think it was like, I felt like I had been good for so long. And I was good in my, you know, my 20s, like part of those 19 to 22-year-old, 24-year-old days are kind of when you're supposed to be bad. And I kind of was too good. So I think my late 20s is when I, you know, I ended up kind of like being a little bit of a maniac. And I ended up having to kind of like, I went down this road of, you know, just kind of drinking too much and, you know, kind of burning bridges in the stand-up comedy world, which I did a lot of that stuff. I remember I had a girlfriend who was a bartender at a very prominent comedy club. Let's just say they have a TV show that's on like basic cable or something, or maybe satellite or something, so you can figure out what club that is. Where they apparently put on just anybody. But anyway, so it was the smaller club before it became the bigger club. My girlfriend was there, and she was a bartender, and then she ended up becoming the booker.
Yeah, isn't there a rule you don't date, I guess, a comedian, you don't date the people who work at comedy clubs or comedians?
Yeah, but...
and this is maybe an example of why.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But she was cute, and she was a little older than me, and she was she introduced me to pot, and like she was just like, she seemed so cultured, and I don't know, it's just, she just reeled me in, man. Just, and it was just like us during the day. Like, she would come in and set the bar up, and I was the day manager. I was, like, working the phones and stuff. And so we kind of, like, started, you know, just it's just us, you know, and there's just two people, and you're just somewhat attracted to each other. Eventually, you end up being, it's like, it don't take much. So, yeah, so we ended up dating and stuff, and then she ended up getting fired. And it became this big thing, and then this guy that came in as a consultant accused her, they accused her of stealing, and I know she wasn't stealing, and it was like this big bullshit thing, because the consultant guy wanted her job, he wanted to be the booker, so he came in. It was this big, huge thing, and this is when, like, I remember I didn't really understand, I mean, I know you're way younger than me, and but there was like, when the internet came out, we didn't really understand it. Like we didn't understand the longevity of it. Like, we didn't understand once you write something, it's forever. You know, none of us, you know, because we didn't come from that. We came from, like, you crumple it up, you throw it in the trash can, and it's gone. Or you delete a message whatever, you know. So I think I might have, there was this thing about the owner of the club, and he was dating a more of a famous comic, and she was saying basically that she liked having sex with this other comedian before him because it didn't hurt when they had sex. So basically she was saying he had a little dick. So I said some things like, yeah, it's a little dick accusing my girlfriend, fuck him, fuck this club, fuck everybody, blah, 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 blah. Sin. And then it was to like, I didn't understand the CC thing. So it went out to like everybody that worked at the club, and then to a whole bunch of other people. For some reason, I was on a thing that was like 20 people deep. So this thing went all over the comedy community. So everybody knew that I called him a little dick, and he reacted like he probably had a little dick. So it became this huge thing, stupid, ridiculous. And basically, it got me kicked out of the club. I've since apologized and tried to be a man about it. He's Italian. He holds it. He still is weird about it. Like, we're friendly, but he'll never book me.
This was like 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
but he'll never book me. He'll never, like, do it. Yeah, but these people hold on to shit.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. It's just like this comedy community. I mean, I've done a lot of crazy shit.
Well, then there's the whole Seller thing.
Well, there's that too. You said you wanted a long show.
Well, I mean, that was in the New York Times.
Yeah, okay, so you read that, yeah. Yeah, I burned a bunch of bridges. Yeah, that was later. Yeah, well, I used to run the Boston Comedy Club, and that's a big club. That was in New York, but they called it the Boston Comedy Club. Let me explain. I know it's stupid, but it was a very famous club here in New York City. It was on West 3rd, right over here, and in Greenwich Village, and it's where Chappelle, Patrice O'Neal, Sarah Silverman, everybody came out of there. Like, before the Cellar, it was like Boston. Like, that's where we got good. Okay, so the owner of it was Barry Katz, who's a producer of The Last Comic Standing. He Whitney Cummings' manager and all this. Like, he's a big dude. But he was in Boston. And so he basically came to New York, and then there was a scene that was happening in Boston. So he wanted to take that scene and have it in New York. So that's why he opened it and called it the Boston Comedy Club. So I ran that for a long time. So I ended up kind of like running the Village. I was the first person to ever do stand-up comedy shows at the Village Lantern. I ran, that used to be one open mic on Mondays, and then it was all music. And I turned that motherfucker into a great comedy club. It was like, and at one time I was running 7 shows a week at the Village Lantern and 7 shows a week at the Boston Comedy Club. And I was running back and forth at the same time, running these shows. And I was full-time shows. And I was running them, but it wasn't like one show a week. Like, every night, great crowds, Jim Norton, big comics, everybody. I was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so I did that for a long time. And Al Martin was the one that bridged me to the Boston Comedy Club thing, because Barry Katz had asked him to help him out because he was in L.A. and he needed somebody to kind of be like an in-between to figure out, you know, the Boston, because they were having problems. And so Al hooked me up with that, and because, you know, we were at the New York Comedy Club together. So we started working together and whatever and developed a good relationship. And so one day Al calls me up, you know, years and years of doing comedy, and he's like, hey, man, there's a little place on 99 McDougal. You know, it's a little abandoned bar. And I was thinking maybe we could do a comedy club. And I know you're the guy because you're Mr. Village and you know how to run comedy in the Village. And, you know, what do you think? And he goes, I know you just passed the Cellar. So this may not be something you want to do. Now, I had been at the Cellar almost 2 years at this point. And, you know, it was like one of those things where it was like, I was there, and they were treating me like a pro. I mean, by this time, I had done Showtime, I had credits, whatever. I was a real comic, and everybody treated me as such. And, you know, I was playing weekends over there, and I was playing, you know, pretty regular. The last couple of months before this was offered to me to run the Greenwich Village Comedy Club, you know, spots were a little sparse, but I was still getting spots, and I was still, you know, I was still past work in the Cellar, which we all know that's a lot of comics, they aspire to that. It's a big deal, I guess. And
yeah, for the non-comics listening, yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, to me, all the clubs have something special, you know. I mean, to me, passing the comic strip was a big deal, because that was the first big club I passed. And to me, that will always hold my heart as the big club, because, you know, I had to have an audition and come back, and it was like, it took me forever, and it's like a year, I had to keep coming back, and I finally passed, and whatever. So, yeah, I mean, the Comedy Cellar is a great place, and a lot of good people have come through there. But at the same time, in the decision of deciding whether I wanted to stay at the Comedy Cellar or open a brand new club with Al here on 99 McDougal, I get to run the shows how I want to run them. I get to book whoever I want. I get to go up whenever I want. I get to do as much time as I want. I get to make this a place for me and for a scene in comedy. I'm all about helping other comics. Like, I've been doing this for so long, and there's a lot of stars that came through me that I've helped out and stuff. And I feel like part of me is a selfish artist, but most of me is somebody that wants to give back to the comedy community, because I feel like if we don't have good comics coming through, then the art dies. And so I feel you gotta have a guy like me that's like looking out for younger comics, because otherwise, you know, it's just gonna be a shitty art form, and the shitty guys are gonna get all the Comedy Central things, and all these people are gonna get famous that aren't being missed. And a guy like me can kind of see talent when it's raw. And so I knew I could do all those things. I always wanted to coach. I always wanted to do all these things. And I feel like if I had my own spot, I could do that. And now, would I end up burning a bridge with the Cellar? Yes. Yeah, they're really weird about competition. They can't seem to figure out, you know what? It's enough pie for everybody. You're the biggest, baddest club. You're going to always have people. They opened up another club around the corner. Like, they're always going to have people.
Yeah.
It's like if you go to New Orleans... You been?
Yeah, I love New Orleans.
Yeah. You walk down, you know, in French Quarter, and it's like jazz club, jazz club, jazz club, jazz club, jazz club, jazz club. Like, there's just tons of jazz clubs. So everybody, you know, nobody, I'm sure the jazz clubs aren't trying to kill each other. They're just like, hey, okay, here's my club, this is what we have, and here's your club. And then, or if it's not jazz club, it's strip club, strip club, strip club. Like, it's, so... McDougal is kind of becoming like that for comedy. You know, it's like we got the Cellar, we got Greenwich, we got the Pear, we got the Lantern. Like, it's just everybody's just, you know, hustling comedy, and it's New York City, and there's enough people for it. So that was my thing. Was I just, you know, it was a really, really difficult decision for me. because I had to make a decision. You know, I was just like, Al was about to open this place. He was going to give me free rein to do it, to do what I wanted to do. I knew it would be a lot of work. I knew it would take away from my purity of just being a comic, but part of me was drawn to it. I was just like, something just great about not having to worry, not having to be like at the mercy of all these clubs all the time. Because I know how comedy is. Comedy's like October, I have like 6 road gigs. Like, bam, good money, good money, good money, good money. Like September, I got 1. Last month, I had like none. So it's like, I know how comedy is. So it's like, you know, I know that it's like, you're at the mercy, and I knew of other people, you know, waiting for them to book you sometimes. Until you're ultra famous, you have to kind of like hustle. And I knew if I had a home base, it would be better for me. And I feel like, you know, the seller thing was very difficult. I had a sit down with them, and like, they basically were like, you know, if you open this place with Al, you won't be able to play here. Won't be able to come in here. You won't be able to be a part of this. You won't be. And it was very difficult because it was like, it was one of my big goals to pass the cellar, and I destroyed when I auditioned. And it was just like, bam! And I was like, I have arrived, motherfuckers. And it was like, it was a big deal for me to pass that club. And then my headshot's on the wall now. And I think it's still up actually, which so that makes me feel good. But you know, it was tough. But in the end, it's like, to me, it's not about playing one club.
Yeah.
You know, it's about playing the Beacon or something.
But there's more places and more people can get better because you need stage time. And it's weird when I read that article how then they were working with the Stand.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's so weird. But comedy is very strange. It's like high school a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
So who are some of the stars you helped meet?
I didn't make them, but I took care of Pete Holmes, was somebody that I took care of. Nate Bergazzi is like a guy that I helped kind of like cultivate. Mike Vecchione is kind of a big comic. Joe DeRosa, you know. I helped Patrice O'Neill a lot. His first comedy special. We ran it probably 20 times. I gave him tags for that special, wrote down and timed it, and like went over it and over it, and kind of helped him like cultivate it and get it right. And so yeah, I mean. There's a lot of people, you know, that are coming up that are kind of, you know, like Jared Free, even the lower guys that are on their way up, like Jared Free, Nimish Patel, who just wrote for the Oscars, Chris Rock. Like there's, you know, and I feel like that's what's great, you know, about this, you know. And then the things with Pete Holmes, he was my barker. And then he ended up, you know, blowing up, being this big comic, and he ended up, you know, developing, creating a show with Judd Apatow for HBO. And, you know, he asked me to be a part of it. So I got to, in episode 3, I get to play myself as a comedian.
Oh, awesome.
I get to do my stand-up. I have a scene with TJ Miller.
I love him. He's fantastic. He's so funny.
We had a funny scene together, a thing, and it was like, it was great. And it made me kind of like, you realize that like, sometimes I get frustrated, like I help too much.
Yeah, you're like seeing everyone else make it. And
yeah, so with this...
That's weird.
But the him giving back,
yeah.
Like this happening, and this year has been really good for me, and, you know, getting some TV stuff happening again and stuff, it made me feel like it's worth it, you know? And then it's just like, I am doing well, and I am, you know, I'm still relevant, and I'm back in charge, and I'm doing my thing, and, you know, it's like, it was a good thing that happened this year for me.
It's almost like you're planting these people up there, so then once you're there, you're already like have these
I mean, it's like, I mean, ultimately I think that's why, you know, if we take care of each other, you know, I always have a running joke where I'm like, you know, when I see somebody getting good, I'll be like, okay, but just make sure you give me a writing job when you get your TV show. And it's kind of a funny like a little line, but it's, you know, I think ultimately you give back, you know, and I think a lot of people have given back to me, you know. It's like, I just opened for Nate and Caroline's, and Pete gave me on this TV show, and you know, some people helped me out with the Fox Red Eye stuff, some comedians and things, and, you know, so,
I think you're rare, though. I don't think comedians help other comedians, especially women, because they think there can only be one female comedian. And even in the clubs, there's always just like one woman on the show.
Yeah, so
then it gets even more competitive, and I'm a big, like, supporter of women. Like, if we come together, like, the more of us together, the more power we have.
Absolutely.
But it's just, it doesn't, a lot of people don't think that way. So then it becomes even more competitive.
Yeah, I mean, I try to help girls too, and try to help people, and I just, you know, it's like, that's, I mean, that's why I started mentoring and coaching people, because I felt like, I think the key to, like, success of most people is they had an older comic looking out for them. They had a veteran comedian or comedian or whatever, just helping them along the way. And so that's kind of why I do this, you know, coach people and stuff, is because, you know, it's a way to kind of, you know, give back, and people, we learn from each other, you know. It's like, you know, and I think young comics and older comics are very important for each other, because it's like, I get to pass on knowledge to you, you get to pass on your enthusiasm, keep me in it, and keep me excited about it. So it's like, between the two of us, it's like, it just keeps it moving. Like, because your enthusiasm makes me excited, and then my knowledge helps you get better. So it's like, we're all just kind of rotating the thing, and that's how comedy stays alive. And that's why sometimes you think maybe it's a bridge or something I shouldn't burn, or maybe you think that I shouldn't do something on my own or break off or take a risk. But in the end, I think it's like, you know, you have to take those chances. You have to take a risk, and you have to try new things. And then if it doesn't work out, you know, you don't have to be Mormon. You know, you don't have to, you don't have to stay at one club and, you know, get bumped by Chris Rock every night. You can open your own club and go on as long as you want. So it's like, you know, it's a weird
thing. Well, it's almost like a longer game play, but
yeah.
That's what I was very surprised about when I got to New York and started doing comedy, was there were all these rules I didn't know. And it's so much about, like, preserving people's egos and kind of how to act, and, like, you can't ask someone to be on your show at their show. Like, all these weird things that I didn't know. And I'm not a good following rules person.
Yeah, me either. Absolutely. I mean, you learn it a little bit as you go, and I think you just have to... Number one is just, like, don't ever let the bullshit or the politics or the craziness or the shitty comics or people that treat you poorly or the clubs or the owners or whatever... Just don't ever let them, you know, drain the enthusiasm out of you. Because if you still enjoy it every time you grab the mic, no matter what kind of room it is, no matter if it's a crappy mic or if it's a show with three people in it or if it's, you know, some crappy road gig or whatever, just enjoy it. As long as you keep the enthusiasm up there and try to, and just always try to be the best comic in the room and get better and all that stuff, you know, it'll work out. And the thing is, the pie is big enough for all of us. Like, we all have a place in it, you know? It's like... You know, like, they're filming a TV thing for my thing, the teaching comics and helping, like, it, whatever you're good at, like, just draw yourself towards that, and good things will come from it. And just stay, you know, stay in it and stay excited and keep being better.
That was such a good idea to do the pilot of you mentoring. Since
yeah.
That's kind of like,
I think it's interesting, yeah. It's, I think it'll be interesting to people because it's something they haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
They've done everything but that. So I think it's something that I don't think, you know, it'll bring people into the world of comedy in a different angle.
Yeah.
Because I feel like whenever they try to do the documentary angle or whatever, I feel like it's always, you know, kind of a
people
similar thing. Yeah, it's a similar thing.
Yeah. So how many people, I'm sure you get this a lot, people say to me all the time, like, oh, I've always wanted to do stand-up. So many people say that, like, or maybe you get this too. Even for my little show, people will be like, oh, can I do it? Can I get up there?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's a process. You don't just say,
yeah,
get on a show.
Sure.
Like, oh, thanks for coming to my show three times. That doesn't mean, like, you get a spot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough, you know. I think you're talking about, like, when people come at you about stage time? Or
well, people who have never done comedy before. Because I think there's, like, this desire in a lot of people to do comedy.
Okay. And, like,
and so no one really, if you haven't done comedy, they don't really know how it works or where it starts or
oh, so
what,
like,
it
what's the steps? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but even doing a pilot of what it takes, like, what how you think about it and writing a set and... Just even basic stuff. Most people have this desire to do comedy, or a lot of people do, and
yeah,
they don't really understand any how it works at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely it can be a little scary, you know, how to attempt this, you know. And I think The problem is most people think they're funny.
Yeah.
Like, you'll get it. Audience members are always like, I'm funny. Everybody told me I should be, they're drunk, I should be a comedian. And I got a joke, and it's always some awful racist joke, and, you know, ridiculous. So, yeah, there is that, you know. You know, for me, when I first started kind of thinking I might want to try this, I studied. I listened to everything I could get my hands on, you know, every comedian. And I remember my mom bought me this whole thing. It was Evening at the Improvs, and it was this, like, volume 1 through 20. And I just watched Seinfeld, and I watched Tim Allen, and I watched Roseanne, and I just watched all these comics, you know, on this thing. And I would get records and CDs and just listen and watch videos and, you know, everything I could get my hands on, man. It was just like I just listened and I took it in and learned. And then the library and bookstores and just every biography and every joke book and anything. I just went crazy. I just, like, tried to absorb as much information as I could because I realized that this is something I like the most. I mean, I was a painter and a designer and a fashion person. I've done a bunch of different things in my life. But this was the one thing that I really went crazy for. And it's like, that's why I knew, you know, I really must want to do this because I just, but I think the information is key. Like, watch people. You can't like say, hey, I want to be a guitarist and not listen to, you know, the blues, you know, or the Beatles, or, you know, like, you have to, Jimi Hendrix or something, like, you know, if you want to do this, then you have to, you know, you have to get the information. You have to get, like, you know, those before you, you know, that did it well, you know, you have to, like, study those people.
Yeah. First time I did any sort of comedy, I think I was 13, and I got in a lot of trouble.
Because you were studying?
Because I convinced my sister, who was 5 years younger, that she'd be like Jerry Seinfeld if she was my basically backup person. Like, oh, how many drinks does it take? Yeah. And then the second time was I was heckling. I was so young. And they're like, oh, come up. They told us to heckle. Then when I heckled, they told me to come up on stage. And I just had one joke that I thought of. And then someone heckled me and said I was a less cute Sarah Silverman. I will never forget that.
You're way cute.
Then I had a break. I had to recover from that. But that's cool that your first experience was so good. Because I'm sure that taints a lot of people.
I'm very happy that it wasn't an open mic or something. Yeah. I mean, because I had it was like a real show. It was, you know, it was like hundreds of people, and it was like a good experience. And it definitely gave me the taste to want more instead of the opposite, which I think I can see that happening with people that do open mics and stuff. But even then, I mean, it's like just every show I've had since then, it's been great. I don't think I've ever had a bad show. I mean, I've had shows where it's like it was shitty and it was awful and some crazy stuff happened. I've been punched on stage. I've had crazy stuff. I've had experiences, ridiculous money, people not wanting to pay. I've had such craziness. But there was still, every single time I've grabbed a microphone, there was one little blurb that was amazing. One little thing, just because I know that how hard it's taken me to get up on that stage. And I know how shy little kid I was and how, like, nervous I was to even try to do this. So the fact that I do it, I've made a strong living at it. I've paid all my bills from doing stand-up comedy since, like, 2 years in. And I just love it. And so even when it's bad, it's good. You know, it's like sex or pizza or whatever they say. It's like, even when it's bad, it's still kind of good. It's still at least you got up and tried to be funny. Even when I bombed, and I haven't really bombed as bad as when I stopped. When I stopped drinking, I stopped having, like, horrible bombs. But when I would drink, I'd be like, fuck yeah, and, like, get in a fight or something, a fist fight or crazy, or throw a bottle. I mean, it was some crazy stuff that happened during those fuzzy years of comedy. And there was a lot of bridges that were burned through that.
Is that why you stopped drinking?
Yeah, basically. I just felt like I lived that rock and roll lifestyle, and it was fun. And now it's time to, you know, get on TV and do some real shit and stop being a little piece of shit and just, you know.
How long ago was that?
8 years ago.
So that was as I turn myself around, I just focus on other things. It's not like I'm a prude, like I don't, you know, I just, you know, I don't do the meeting crap or anything. I just, you know, I did for a little while, and then I just kind of, you know, 5 years I haven't really done any of that, but I just, you know, kind of just focus on just other things, you know. I shifted towards, you know, other addictions, you know, whether it be sugar or whatever. I mean, I definitely have my vices, but, you know, I'm not sloppy on stage anymore. And then I don't have to worry about some, you know, pulling my dick out or some blackout or some crazy thing happen on stage or a fist fight or, you know, cops being called or, you know, those things don't have to happen. Smacking a girl's ass because I was emceeing. Hey, Rachel Feinstein just smacking her ass. Oh my God. You know, stuff like that. Just because you're just drunk, you don't know. It's not that I'm a terrible person.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like, you know, there's time to do that. And then there's a time to, like, get your shit together. And so I feel like this is my year to get my shit together in the past couple of years. And it's been fun. It's been a good ride. I love stand up. I love everything about it. I don't compare myself to people anymore. I just, like, go after what I want, and, you know, it's been good.
Seems like you're doing what you're intended to do. Like, you seem like a very intuitive person.
I think so, yeah. I think I connect to people, and I feel I can see what maybe they kind of wanting to get out. But yeah, it's definitely, it was either this or therapy. I think I'd be good. I've always said, I tell my therapist, I go, I could totally do this. I would be really good at this. I'm just saying, if I get bored with comedy, I might get the degree and do this. So, you know, I think that's definitely similar.
Are you spiritual at all? I mean, you...
Not really, not really. You know, I mean, I would like to get, you know, my grandfather's Native American stuff, and I'd like to get more into that stuff again. It was a time where I explored that a little bit, but I mean, I just, you know, believe in being good to people and karma and stuff, and, you know, treating people well and it'll come back, and, you know, that kind of, that's about as spiritual as I get. There's not an intensity to it. I believe in everything. I believe there's a possibility in everything. You know, I believe, like, I don't dismiss spirituality or, you know, people that have gifts and things. I believe that stuff exists, but for me, it's just, comedy's kind of my spiritual thing, you know, and just helping other people, giving back to people, helping people like yourself and other comics and things, and that is kind of fills that spiritual void that it might be missing, so.
Well, maybe you'll learn some spiritual stuff from my jokes. I'll convert you. Since
convert me. I like it.
I'll be, like, competitive. Let's see who can become more psychic.
Yeah. Well, read my cards one night. I'd love to, like, if
okay.
you do that. I'll
yeah, well,
that
do you
stuff.
Know what time you're born and your location?
Yeah, we don't have to do it on the air, though. I don't
yeah,
know
no.
Taking all my all right. information down. Open up a credit card. I gave you, like, all my information. I was born in 19... No.
Well, my Kabbalah astrologer, she answers people's questions. All right, I'll let you go.
No, it's fine. Are we off, or...
Oh, no.
Oh,
but
okay.
I'll say
we're
goodbye.
Still going? Okay.
Thank you so, so, so much. I know this interview is going to have so many listens in, like, 6 months. When does that TV show come out?
I think it comes out January.
This is
going to
be my highest listen episode. Thank you for the future.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Well, I'll get it out there. We'll promote.
If you want to see Dustin's comedy or hire him as a coach, check him out on his website, Dustin Chafin, CHAFIN.com. Do you like free booze and free stand-up comedy? Well, then you would love the Underground Comedy Show at the Bitcoin Center in Soho every Thursday at 7 p.m., unless it's raining, at 25 Cleveland Place.
And to donate, go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge.